usually when I'm asked to speak, I'm asked to speak on how we finance water solutions for urban or municipal users. And I'll say, while there are many, many challenges to financing toward a more sustainable water future, especially if you look at the 80% of water that's used by agricultural users, what we have when we look on the municipal water side is not a financing problem any more than it's a financing problem if I want to buy a 5,000 square foot house and I want to do it with 0% down and I want to have a 0% interest rate. That's not really a financing problem. That's a problem of expectations. And I would say that's the problem that most cities and hopeful cities that are now small communities are running into, which is especially in the West, that water use patterns, our expectations of how much we pay for water and what we use it for, developed within an environment in which water users were paying the lowest prices for water in the entire U.S., even though they were drawing on some of the scarcest resources, because the water users weren't the ones who built or paid for the infrastructure projects that delivered their water. It was the federal government that paid for those projects and the U.S. taxpayer that paid for those projects. And the economics today of supplying new water, water that will have to be built by and paid for by the rate base within those areas, because the era of federal largesse has passed. There are many, many efforts underway to try to get states to assume the role that the federal government once assumed in building those water resources, but many of those are not really going anywhere fast. That economic reality of escalating cost of water supplies is coming up against a reality of declining water demand, which very few people recognize or understand. So if you go to Texas, if you go to Nevada, if you go to Arizona, the assumption is that as the population grows, demand for water in those cities will grow with it. And that is an assumption that has not played out in reality over the past 30 or 40 years. Water use has remained flat in many areas. The amount of water that the typical household uses has been declining, and in some areas has declined quite precipitously. And that is a very important thing for us to recognize when we're looking at developing water projects that are the most expensive water projects we've ever thought about building. So the city of Las Vegas, the Southern Nevada Water Authority, is looking at building a groundwater importation project that would deliver water and be a substitute for the water they use from the Colorado River right now. When all is said and done, when that project is actually financed, that's going to be about a $16 billion project that we will be built on the backs of the households and the businesses in Southern Nevada. And it's a very compelling question about whether or not they can afford that. But an equally compelling question is, what are our incentives to exercise demand management, to actually get us to a point where we're using water efficiently if you're paying for a project that is that expensive? And this is a very real challenge that many water systems are facing today. They're seeing demand declining within their service area. They don't know why it's declining. They never expected it to decline as much as it has, even if they invested over time in conservation programs, in low-flow toilets, and the rest of it. And there are a number of reasons why it's happening. We have more water-efficient appliances. We actually have prices that are starting to communicate to the consumer the actual cost of using that extra $1,000 or 1,000 gallons of water to water a lawn. And that's shifting people's use of water. But 80% of the money that water systems take in depends on how much water you and I buy. And yet they have fixed costs for paying for the pipelines they build, the reservoirs they build, and the rest of it. And when the amount of money coming in from water sales starts to get too close to that fixed amount that they have to pay out the door to investors, they start to take measures to make sure that that decline doesn't continue. And so you see in Southern Nevada, you see Las Vegas now having once paid people to rip up the lawn that was requiring all that water. They're now allowing them to put the lawn back in very quietly because they need that money. It's a governance problem because the amount we pay for water actually is mostly determined by city councils. It's determined by elected representatives. And so when the story that people see when they read their newspapers are the cost of water is going up, you need to show up to a rate hearing and contest that. That's the story that they take away. But we're kind of at a decision point right now where either we can kind of double down on supply, we can build expensive supply projects for a demand that I would argue isn't there. It's phantom demand. And we can lock ourselves into a future where people are going to pay more for water than they've ever paid and not have the flexibility to use less and pay less. You're going to be paying that amount of money no matter how much water you use, and it'll be a real affordability issue. Or we can educate people about why they're going to have to pay more for water today than they have before, but how they can choose to pay for it in a way that allows them to be flexible and to decide how much water they use. And that's a story that's hard to tell, but it's a really important story.
Okay. Judy, I bet you want to talk about demand.
I'm Judy Reeves, and I am a hydrogeologist. I have worked most of my career on the Southern High Plains on the Ogallala Aquifer. As probably most of you know, the Ogallala Aquifer is, well, you can look at it as a wedge-shaped aquifer that the thinnest section is in the southern part of the Ogallala, and the thickness of the Ogallala increases as you go to the north up to Nebraska and up into the Dakotas. Because we're at the we have the short end of the stick, being in the southern part of the Ogallala on the southern high plains. Therefore, we're at the leading edge of a water crisis in the Ogallala. The thing that I have observed throughout my career is it is clearly written in the historical record that there's a one way that the aquifer is depleting, and it has been just going in that one single direction through the whole 50, 60 years that we have the historical record. Like Sherry said, the groundwater has been actively managed in this in the Southern High Plains for 60 years now, and it really has unfortunately not affected that downward decline of the aquifer. I believe Sherry did mention that 95% or even a little bit more of that water is for agricultural use. The groundwater management techniques have changed through time. The managers here on the Southern High Plains have always used public education as one management technique. And there's still, despite all that public education, there's still a low level of cultural cognition. They've used the well spacing, as Sherry mentioned. And the well spacing really, it does not affect, there's no savings in an aquifer when you just control the well spacing, and that is because you're just protecting the well owners. There's no preserving and protecting an aquifer with well spacing. They've also used irrigation, improved the irrigation efficiency to the credit of the ag producers. The irrigators on the Southern High Plains are high tech. Most of their techniques are 95 and upper 90% efficiencies. Unfortunately, that irrigation efficiency, they didn't use that efficiency to save water in the aquifer. They instead they used it to increase the yields of their crops. So that really didn't preserve and protect the aquifer as well. Now, currently, because of a state mandate, as Sherry mentioned, we have to have a desire. They determined desired future conditions, and they decided that on the high plains, for the first 50 years of use, we used up about 50% of the aquifer. Now, in the next 50 years, they determined that they want to use another 50%. And so 50% of the saturated thickness of the aquifer is supposed to be from today, or from 2010, is supposed to remain in the aquifer in 2060. in the 50-year management cycle. So I did prepare a handout. It's sitting at the back, and this actually shows their production limits that they have designated, and I compare it to, and I translate those production limits to saturated thickness, depletion of the aquifer, and I do not see that with their designated production limits that there is going to be they won't meet their goals of 50% reduction in the future. So the bottom line that I see from the historical record is that, and I think a lot of people do agree with this, is that agriculture cannot be sustained on the Southern High Plains. One of the things that we need to do is look at the managers have always they're not looking at sustainability of the aquifer, and we do need to look at the future and look at sustainability. I feel that I'm not anti-agriculture. I would like to say, though, that I feel that all of us are just as responsible for the as the egg producers, because we're all consumers and we all are citizens. So as consumers and citizens, we have the ability to make better choices. I just heard that 40% of the food we use is waste, or we on the table is wasted. We need to make better food decisions. We all have closets full of clothing we don't need. We need to make good decisions as consumers and as citizens. We can elect people who will look into the future. And on the Southern High Plains, I really think that we need to start talking about what is the next economy that is going to be able to sustain the aquifer and on the Southern High Plains.
Thank you, Judy. Earlier we said that I guess the impression that I got from you, Charlene, was that you think the environmentalism movement is causing people to use less water, right? They're becoming more conscious of their footprint.
I think it's less about decisions that people are making, and it's more about policy choices that were made a couple of decades ago that have taken it out of the hands of the consumer to use less water. So you look at, there's a 1992 Energy Act that required more efficient dishwashers, washing machines, the rest of it. That has had a really substantial impact on, declines in indoor use without the customer ever knowing it. You just, when you go to Home Depot or wherever else to buy a new washing machine, you are buying a washing machine that uses less water than the one that you bought 20 years ago. That's gone a long way. The big challenge for water systems is, depending on where they are, between 50 and 80% of their water sales are used to water lawns. So that is very much at the discretion of the customer. And there are ways of adapting the way that people make choices there. Pricing is one of them. Mandatory restrictions are one of them that often are just used during extreme drought conditions. But as you see in Texas, in some areas, those decisions weren't effective enough to keep reservoirs from being completely drawn down. So really what it gets down to is how we adapt our pricing so that we have more consistent demand management over time and it's not emergency.
I want to add one thing. This isn't a groundwater conservation district issue.
Can you lean into the mic?
That's right. I come from the city of Lubbock, and one of the other problems that we have also, I agree with Charlene, is not only we have small community. I sat in a city council meeting the other day of a very small community here in Lubbock, and they were considering putting watering restrictions on their lawns. Well, they can't do that because of the way their structure is set up. They won't be able to pay for the maintenance on their system. Forget delivering a drop of water, just the maintenance. But what's happened also is when most of the water systems were put in across the United States, that was 75 to 100 years ago. Well, concrete lasts 75 to 100 years. What nobody did, most municipalities, and even Lubbock, the one that I live in now, They didn't put money aside to replace that infrastructure. So not only are they grappling with acquiring new water sources, managing water consumption, but now they have the huge expense of putting, of replacing water systems. I'm sorry, the actual physical infrastructure that gets water from place to place. And we see that, even when we were doing our, when we were promulgating our rules, we paid special attention to our small municipalities, because one thing that we didn't want to do is harm them to the extent that the community itself could no longer sustain itself, because it couldn't produce wells, it couldn't produce water from the existing wells. I mean, that goes into a lot of issues inside of our rules, but that was a very viable. I'm not going to say viable because that means living. It's definitely something to consider out there. It compounds every single thing we do. We've gotten water so inexpensively, and I can't remember which one of these said, it's basically been free until recently, and we've never paid the value, we've never paid what value water was valued at. And now we're going to have to, and it's going to upset most people because it's truly, truly expensive to go back in time. But that's one thing I wanted to add to, it's not just the consumers being able to use the water and use less, which we definitely, that's what everybody wants. We want every drop used exactly right. But we still have some delivery issues that cities are quite honestly required by law to make at certain levels. So that's another thing to compound all of this, is just an aging infrastructure. And that's a big one that often folks don't realize, because it's underground, you don't see it. So anyway, that's...
Do you want to speak to that? Kristen, do you want to speak to that?
No.
Okay.
I want to hear what they have.
Okay. Let's go ahead and open it up to questions.
She used the term sustainability. What the term I hear running around mostly is managed depletion is really what it is. It is. Now, we'll tell you that one thing that Judy says that is imperative.
Can you lean forward, Sherry?
Oh, that's right. Is what economy, what is the next economy to take us into the future? You're right, it is agricultural for us right now, but is it going to be agriculture forever? Probably. I agree with what she's saying. We need to be looking forward. The district, and I'm not, I can just tell you that it's out there, I can't speak to it, but the district actually worked with Texas Tech on doing an economics study of the results of our rules, and you can find that on our website. So our board members are very, they realize what they're doing. They're trying very hard not to wipe agriculture out now. We would like agriculture to take us forever. Can it be done? I don't know. And I'm not even qualified to look at what Judy's produced. But I will tell you one thing. The groundwater management plan that we are required to have, we have to look at it every 5 years to see if it's going in the direction. Do we need to raise the stakes? Do we need to lower them? What are the options out there? We can look at it and change it as frequently as we want, but we are mandated by law to look at it every single 5 years, every 5 year period. And so we're at the beginning of the DFC, the desired future condition. We call it DFC. We're at the beginning of that project right now. In fact, we've only got, I think, not even a year under our belt yet. And so we're very interested to see where it goes with our rules as well. We also can't impose any rules without public input, and it's a public rulemaking process. So when the board set out their original set of rules, we had several months and several public hearings worth of input to help us come up with those rules, and that's also where we came up with the rules. So, and like I said, I can't articulate what she's got. Our hydrologist probably could. Like I said, managed depletion is a term that is used around us as well. And I don't know if Judy can speak to it or cares to, but I don't know that recharge is an option for us. I think usage is our solution. Would you agree? Mm-hmm. So recharging the aquifer it's not going to happen. So it is going to be our usage. And of course, the least expensive water you will ever buy is the water you don't use. So that's...
And to restate the question, what she asked was, aren't you going to run out of water? Go ahead, Judy.
I'll just add that the management goal is to manage depletion. There is no intent of sustainability on the Southern High Plains, which that as far as recharge is concerned, the recharge to the aquifer naturally is just from precipitation, what falls on the southern high plains and percolates down to the aquifer. That's, you know, roughly, you know, it varies from place to place, but you could consider it less than like a half an inch a year. The, for the last 50 years, our historical record, we're depleting the aquifer by over a foot a year. This last year, an average, with the drought conditions, we depleted it on average 2.54 feet. So there's a huge discrepancy there.
I'll just say, you know, this is not just a problem in the high plains, and many of you probably know that, but another area that is similarly kind of, I don't even know if they're managing depletion or if they're just depleting right now, is Central Valley in California, which, you know, altogether, I think both regions produce about $60 billion worth of agricultural products a year.
Sure, can you lean in?
Yeah, and this is one of the largest food sources in the United States. So, you know, this is not just a story of the high plains, but it's happening throughout the West in ways that are going to touch consumers all over the world.
Then I had a question for Kristen, but I didn't realize that first one would take so long.
That's okay.
It's okay. I think you want to address that too, don't you?
Well, I'd like to hear a question. I might be able to tie it in. So. Thank you.
Because it was about your major theme, energy.
Right.
You said that 90%.
So the question is, why isn't energy using less water, I think, would be.
Right. I will say there are, in general, overall trends in the future in terms. Yes, sorry, I need to lean in. I need to remember the rules. Right now, about half the power plants in the United States, so I'm going to, let's talk specifically west of the Mississippi. They use a process that's a thermoelectric cooling process where it's evaporative cooling. They take water into a power plant, and then there's, you see, again, I said the plumes of steam that are evaporated. In the east of the Mississippi, most of the power plants use a once-through process. They take water into the power plant, and then they dump the water back into a river, a lake, or a reservoir. The rules, and these are some policies coming out of EPA, are changing, such that all new power plants are very likely to employ not the once-through technology, but these evaporative cooling technologies. That means that we can expect in the future declines in overall water withdrawals from the electricity and power industry. However, the power plants that are around right now, they had lifetime of a power plant, a nuclear power plant, for example, 50 years, and a lot of them get relicensed for up to 75 years. And so those old technologies, they can't necessarily be replaced without significant economic investments, which are passed on to the ratepayers. So that's one reason why we haven't observed those, you know, we've seen modest increases, but in the future, we actually expect overall declines nationally in terms of water use for electricity generation. That said, we have some recent results. I just got these last week, where we're working with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory to look at where we can expect future power plants to be built out and what kind of water use schemes might be employed. And although across the United States, we might expect overall declines of about 50% in total water use by electricity industry, we can expect in the Southwest water use to remain stagnant or to increase modestly. That's because we have a lot of people that are moving here. We have huge population growth, and we're already, believe it or not, using less water per unit of electricity generated in the West than is being used in the rest of the country. So we really don't have anywhere to go but up. That said, that's under a business-as-usual case with high penetration of natural gas. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, but what was
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't get to that.
Is that wind?
So, I'm sorry. So there's wind, and there are certain types of solar power that actually don't use water. That said, it's worth noting that low carbon technologies and electricity generation are not necessarily low water. A nuclear power plant, for example, uses roughly 1,000 gallons of water for every megawatt hour that's generated. Concentrated solar plants, you're still using a steam process to generate electricity. They use just as much water. Unfortunately, where are most of the solar solar resources. They're really warm, really dry areas where there isn't a lot of water. Therefore, we're actually seeing proposed power plants. They are proposed, they want to use quote unquote dry cooling. It's a very different type of technology. That said, it's very expensive on the initial build out. It's not as cheap. And water, when you're talking about the energy industry, water is cheap. Even at the rates that they pay, it's still cheap relative to the fuels and relative to the building of the infrastructure that's required. So that 10%, it is filled out quite a bit by wind and other technologies.
Okay. No worries. Thank you, Cynthia. Yes, in the back. Can you stand up and state your name, please, and your affiliation?
Yeah. So the question is, if the business model, the revenue model of a water system is to sell more water, or at least the same amount of water, and yet we have declining resources and declining demand, how do you actually break that cycle? And I'll say what's interesting here is that, 80% of water that's delivered in the U.S. is delivered by public systems. So we're not even talking about a profit motive here. We're just talking about public systems that need to pay back the debt that they've incurred to build the systems that provide our water. It all comes down to pricing, and it comes down to building a rate structure that communicates the cost of water that's delivered, that encourages buyers to use less water, while also creating a stable enough revenue that those systems can honor their debt. And that's it's a sweet spot that's hard to find. And it is a financial experiment that carries with it real risk because, first of all, there's political risk. As I said earlier, it's really city councils, it's elected officials in most places that are making decisions about how much we pay for water. And none of them have an incentive to ensure that there's long-term affordability that's protected because they're just trying to stay in office or get reelected. And there have been places where people have been booted out of office because of water rates. So it's a very real risk. From our standpoint, the drivers of better rate design are going to come from two places. One, they're going to come from the market. Water systems care an awful lot how much they pay when they go to market, because if you're financing a $1 billion capital improvement plan, the cost of interest that you pay can mean, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars for your rate payers. That's why we're trying to get credit rating agencies to ask better questions. We're trying to get them to understand the relationship between the price people pay for water, their demand for water, and revenue stability. And we're doing the same with institutional investors as well. I think it's also very much a political exercise. And absent from most of these rate hearings have been the conservation advocates, who have really an invested interest in ensuring that our water utilities are able to financially sustain themselves while pursuing efficiency. Also, low-income advocates need to be there at the table. I'll give you another example. The San Antonio water system is one of the largest water systems in the U.S. They have been, for some time, one of the most progressive systems in investing in water efficiency because they had to. But they managed to do it in a way that didn't really affect their customers. It's a very low-income community for the most part, and they've managed to reduce the amount of water that's used every day by about 100 million gallons of water a day over the last 10 years have been reduced within that city, without substantially increasing the amount the amount that people pay for water, which is a very big accomplishment. It's one that should be celebrated and has been celebrated. The problem is that city council and the chairman of their board are telling them they have a broken business model, because what they're hearing from is the 20% of the community that for a very long time was able to water their lawns cheaply and is not able to do that anymore, and is a very politically activated community that wants city council to hear their voice and to act on that. The low-income community and their advocates have not really been present at the table there, and they need to be, because the plan now is to build out new water supply sources that are very expensive, and to do that in a way that is paid back by ratepayers across the entire rate base. It doesn't matter that that water is being secured to water lawns by 20% of the wealthiest people in that city. And that's a story that might be kind of the most acute in San Antonio, but honestly is very similar to what's happening in many other places. So that, you know, for those political decisions to be made for the long-term good of the customer, you have to have the right political constituencies involved.
Okay, thank you. On this side, yes, go ahead. Yes, sorry.
So in terms of what's being done to essentially increase efficiency in the agriculture industry. Now, I'm going to, there are kind of two different takes on this. The first, yes, you can line ditches. There's a lot of different sort of tax. I would expect there are some folks here who might be able to better address that particular part of the question. But the other thing that I think is worth considering, and this kind of ties the surface water issue to the groundwater issue, is the legal availability of water and how the law, particularly the law of the river and the doctrine of prior appropriations on the upper Colorado, lower Colorado, how that really plays into water use. If I have my appropriation of water, I mean, if this glass is my appropriation of water and I don't use it all, then yeah, I can pass it on to somebody else. That said, the way that prior appropriation works, I need to use all of this. And so it's not necessarily the way that it doesn't necessarily incentivize conservation or efficiency. And that's not just for agriculture, that's across the board. There are some places, arguably some places in Colorado, where, and this issue does come up, I'm going to characterize it as quote unquote demand hardening. How far can you go? How far can conservation take us? Not just in our homes, not just with agriculture, but how far can we get before we cry uncle and we can't do anything else? And there are places in Colorado where they've said, we can't do anything else. We are conserving the most that we can with respect to the particular crops we're growing and our water use. But I expect that others have some comments on some of the tactics that are being taken. I don't know.
Well, as I mentioned, with agriculture on the southern high plains, the efficiencies are in the upper 90 percentiles. They can't get more efficient, basically. So that management technique is spent, basically. There's a lot of research done on different crops, but you know nobody's talking about a crop that is that they can produce without water, and so that's why specifically to the Southern High Plains, I believe that that agriculture cannot be sustained, and we need to start looking at a different economy that is going to be able to, sustain the people in this region in the future. I believe the writing's on the wall with agriculture.
I do want to add one thing. There are ways to incentivize people. Kristen's right. Usually you have a bucket of water, and if you don't use it all, you lose it all. One of the things that we did in our rules to encourage folks to use as little as possible as they can every year is they get to bank water up to a certain amount of inches.
Sorry.
Is it still not there? They get to bank water. They get to pay it forward, essentially. So, for example, if you get 15 inches per acre this year and you only use 9, you get to take the balance of that and move it into the future. And it's a rolling, I think it's a 3-year rolling. It kind of drops off. You can't, well, first of all, your wells wouldn't be able to produce that huge amount in the future if you needed it anyway, but it is an amount that you get to roll forward. And our producers, that was their idea, and our board agreed with it. And it works quite well for us, or we're hoping that it works quite well. We're hoping that instead of emptying their glass this year, they will go ahead and try to save some for the future, because we had, just at the time that we were promulgating our rules, we had a prime example. We went from a really wet year into an extremely dry year. So people had their all-time low and their all-time high just almost back to back. And so while it didn't appear to be the best time for us to be promulgating rules on the end of a really dry year, at least folks had some background data saying, oh, this banking it might work. So there are ways that we can try to get them to not use it all this year by holding it. Now, we don't allow them to give it to somebody else, like appropriation, some of the surface rules do. You get to keep it for yourself. But at least it's there, and we've got some folks that are interested in banking their water.
Leah, can I also just mention the role of corporations in driving change?
Sure.
This is another part of the work that we've been doing. As I mentioned, we represent institutional investors, and we've seen quite a bit of attention from the shareholder community on water risks to agricultural producers, food and beverage companies, even apparel manufacturers, all of which rely on agricultural commodities and which have seen a lot of pricing dislocation in the past 5 years because of droughts in Texas and various other areas. And there is an expectation now growing among shareholders that companies be looking not only into their own operations and their water use, but more deeply into their supply chains and the way that creates risks for them. I'll give you an example. Coca-Cola is one of the companies that's been doing quite a bit and actually has taken proprietary data on the state of water resources globally and made it public, recognizing this is actually a public governance issue, one that's going to have to be managed by their competitors and everybody else. And, you know, I think that there is a whole lot of opportunity that's yet to be tapped into in looking more deeply into those supply chains from companies that might not be in California or in Texas but are buying an awful lot of product from those areas. The challenge that hasn't been resolved yet is also not only how do they understand their vulnerability, put out different expectations around use of water, but how does corporate finance come to play in financing those agricultural efficiencies? Because these are not high margin markets for these producers. And it is really not realistic for them to have to finance transition to new crops, transition to new sorts of, smart irrigation systems that present a very significant upfront capital cost. So that hasn't been resolved yet, and let's be honest about that. But
Did we have another question from this side of the room? Go ahead. You've had your hand up a while. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the status of desalination?
And is it a kind of offer or are we talking about? We have the karst aquifer there.
Ogallala is a freshwater aquifer. We do have, beneath the Ogallala aquifer is the Dockham aquifer, and it is, has a lot of salinity to it. And so they are talking about, tapping into that aquifer. In fact, last year, I was part of a Texas Tech research project where we drilled a well for a small community in West Texas as their water supply well into the Dockham. And they're using wind energy to not only pump the well, but also to desalinate. This is an experimental project, but so far it's expensive, but it is a new source of water that, you know, may become viable. Right now, desalinization is not really cost effective, but it's getting more so all the time.
The Edwards Aquifer Authority was also created by the legislature, and it is separate and different from us. They have some powers and authority that we don't have, but I can't speak to those. But they are different. All other groundwater conservation districts, which is what we are, they were all created by the state under the groundwater, And Edwards had so many unique issues. I think they tried to do a groundwater conservation district and somehow.
Yeah, that could be a panel in itself.
Oh, yeah. And they are not a state agency. They are also created by the legislature, but under a different method as us. And I can't tell you the difference between the two.
Yeah, they're a pretty strong agency in the state.
Yeah.
Go ahead, in the back. She's asking, when will the Ogallala run out, and what would be the economic impact of the area when that happens? As you transition to some other kind of...
Okay, to answer the first question, like we... Pardon?
Lean in a little bit more.
Okay.
There we go.
Answering the first question, there's a spreadsheet that I put at the back of the room, and it addresses depletion... depletion of the aquifer. If the producers use the allowable rates, the allowable quantities that are now part of the groundwater management plan. And so what it is basically for the next 2 years, the producers can use 1.75 acre feet of water. Following 2 years, 1.5 acre feet. And then after that, through the next 50 years, 1.25 acre feet. And that's just water. And then when you translate that to saturated thicknesses, I show on this spreadsheet, it'll vary depending on what your saturated thickness is that you start out with. But for instance, if you have 200 feet of saturated thickness, which is something that we frequently have in the northern part of the southern high plains, it'll take about 10 years if they use those quantities to where we deplete the aquifer to the point of 50% remaining. If you have 100% or 100 feet of saturated thickness to start out, which is very typical of the Lubbock area and the central portion of the southern high plains, will deplete. And again, if the producers use that amount that they are allowed to use, depletion to 50% of their origin, to 50% will be in 5 years. And if we start out with 50 feet of saturated thicknesses, which is very typical of the southern part, the very southern wedge where the Ogallala is thinning out, in about 3 years, we can deplete the aquifer. Well,
can you repeat what she said?
I believe you asked, will they have to stop using the water when they get down to that 50? Well, it's up to the High Plains Water Districts. The water districts are the enforcers of the rules. And so we have yet to see how that plays out. The other part of the question was was whether or not people are looking at a different economic base for this region, and I'm sure that the researchers at Texas Tech and different universities are doing that. I've heard things like solar, wind energy, retirement communities. There are different options for the Southern High Plains that are not ag-based, but as far as what I see in the groundwater management meetings, and I've been going to them for 20, 25 years, no one is talking about the future and that. And I think that discussion needs to be, that needs to be discussed at the proper venue for that discussion is in groundwater management meetings.
And have you seen that across the state? Not just here.
In this part of the state, it's the board members are all ag producers, and have been for the last 60 years since the inception of groundwater districts, and so it's certainly the case here. Some of the management meetings that I look in the like in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I think there's a little bit more. The boards are comprised of a broader base, and there's a little bit, and there's more attention to the future.
Okay. Kristen wanted to comment on the desal question earlier.
Yeah, I just kind of, again, I've been talking a lot about the Colorado River surface water. Seems like you run out of surface water, you go to groundwater. You run out of groundwater, then we're going to talk about cleaning dirty water. We're going to talk about desal. There's a large desal plant that's being proposed for Carlsbad in Southern California, or in California. And the energy requirements for that plant are on par with the energy that it takes to move water up and over the Rocky Mountains. It's incredibly energy intensive. And something that I grapple with and I wonder about, and my colleagues might have comments as well, I said water is cheap for the energy industry, but energy is going to be really expensive for water management. And we're talking about pumping from groundwater. We're talking about cleaning water. We're talking about cleaning saline water. I really wonder about what is going to do to the price of water as well as the price of energy across the entire Western United States. We're really looking, it's not just a water for energy issue, it's an energy for water issue. Already in California, 20% of the electricity generated in California is for moving water. More electricity is used in Arizona for the Salt River Project and the Central Arizona Project than for anything else. Nevada, number one consumer of electricity, is the water sector. So this is something I think we also have to be thinking about in terms of a broad Western strategy, thinking about what I like to characterize as mitigation in terms of how, and adaptation. Climate mitigation, adaptation. We want to move water. We want to clean water. We want to provide water to a growing population when we have less water. That's going to come at a carbon cost and at a cost to our energy industry, and vice versa. Generating electricity, maybe low carbon, not always low water. So I just want to comment on that.
Go ahead, Judy.
I just wanted to comment that not only do we need to, I mean, not only is energy a big issue, but actually the moving the water. For instance, T. Boone Pickens wanted to move the water from the High Plains over to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And even, he was unsuccessful, and it was because of the cost of moving the water. The estimates were like $1 million a mile to get to play in place the, you know, pipeline to get the water moved over to the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Anybody else want to comment on that? We had a scenario in Midland where I live where they put water restrictions on, and then Midland bragged about the reduce of water usage. And the reason it had reduced the water usage is because in 6 months they drilled 465 water wells. Do y'all want to address that? Anybody want to talk about
those
that?
Those private drillers who are coming in?
Yes, they are
doing. Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge that still it amazes me when we sit down with, you know, credit rating agencies or buyers or even, you know, policymakers. People don't seem to understand, you know, people will go to the cheapest source of water they can find. If you can drill a well, you'll drill that well. If the cost of buying water from the person you've always bought water from increases by 50%, you're going to drill a well if you have an option. It's not just about drilling wells. It's Metropolitan Water District of Southern California is seeing this problem. And this is much bigger wells that are being drilled by their contractors. So Met, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie Chinatown, but, you know, Met is one of the biggest water buffaloes that the state of California has. And it was created to be able to buy and move and sell water from the State Water Project, moving water down from Northern California to Southern California. And that was all well and good, and it was a business model that looked just great until they became the highest cost producer in the state of California. And the communities that they have sold to for years and years have just decided, we don't need your water. We're going to drill our own wells, and we're going to deplete our aquifer. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. They're choosing cheap groundwater. So this is real business risk for water providers, and it's one that gets negated because, you know, people think that the economics of water use aren't changing. They're changing dramatically.
Well, and with the effect of the drought, now Midland's drilling a pipeline from Kermit, too. So anybody else have a question? Go ahead.
I would say on the energy side, I'm not sure that we're seeing any credit movements happening because of water, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to happen in the near term. We were talking a little bit earlier about the costs of either stranding an electric power plant if it no longer has access to water or has a system that's no longer viable or cost effective. There have been some estimates done on what it would actually take for the existing power fleet in the United States to transition away from once through cooling, either toward air cooling or toward more water recycling kind of systems. And for a single power plant, it could be anywhere from $100 million to $1 billion for one power plant. Now that's, I think, partly what is kind of slowing down some of the EPA's regulations for existing power plants, is that that's a very real cost. It's one that may or may not get passed through to ratepayers. It's certainly not one that the administration wants to act on before the election. So we'll see what happens after the election. And that will create real credit risk depending on the way those regulations come down. From shareholders, I think that there's been heightened awareness of the relationship between power production and water needs. I think that has played out, especially this last year. You know, people I think, understood that intuitively in the Southwest, maybe even in the Southeast, where there were some, generation shutdowns or reductions during heat waves. But this year, one of the largest nuclear facilities in the state of Connecticut had to basically go offline for 3 days because ocean water got too hot to use. And it wasn't a permitting limit that they ran into. It was that their system, their engineering system for cooling, just wasn't able to use the ocean water at that temperature. So then that's a whole other game. It's not freshwater resources. There's plenty of ocean water, but if it gets too hot and you have, you know, a major, baseline facility that has to go offline in the middle of a heat wave, you know, that's an awful lot of cost to a generator. So I think we'll see more questions from shareholders, not a whole lot of credit movements right now. But one other thing that I like to stress, whether it's a water utility or anybody else who's active in the debt markets, is, it doesn't really matter what your credit rating is if the largest buyers think that you're a bad bet, because that shapes the cost that your debt trades at. And we're seeing that being actually a huge motivator for water systems, is to make sure that the investors think that they're a safe bet. There's going to be a proliferation of water risk tools that are going to be coming out there for the investment community. Bloomberg New Energy Finance is releasing a water insight service next month or next week, actually. There's just going to be a panoply of them, and that's not going to do anything but kind of sharpen investor attention to this and make it all the more important for companies to be transparent.
Does anybody else want to comment on that? No? We have time for about one more question.
You're in the front.
I'm trying to go side to side in the room. Go ahead.
Okay.
So basically what you're asking is infrastructure losing more water, right?
Is that what you're talking about? Is water loss from infrastructure?
Yeah, I thought that already broke.
Well, it's been 6 years since I've been with the city of Lubbock. But when I was there, I was with the water distribution system. And one of the things that you have automatically is there's a lot of leak detection equipment out there now. However, what happens is when you're staging in the replacement of your system, the city of Lubbock actually had a very small acceptable, whatever the standard under the American Water Works Association, there's a standard that as long as you stay within that, then you've got a pretty healthy system. And the city of Lubbock actually did. But we tried to stay when we couldn't replace our system. We did try to go, and we had whole crews just to go out and fix leaks and pipe. Now, the beauty with Lubbock, though, and this is different with a lot of people, when we have a water leak, it doesn't percolate down. It comes right to the surface, so we know it's there. There's places like Dallas, they can have leaks in their system for decades and never know the leak. Well, they know it's there because it's metered. They've got what's coming out of their system and what's being metered to their customers. So they know there's a leak, but they can't find it. And they have a giant, giant distribution system. With us here in Lubbock, ours just comes to the surface. And so I can assure you, the minute that we have a leak, we got a call. So we knew right where to go to fix it. So just because of the soil conditions in our area, that was an advantage for us. If you check the American Water Works Association, there are thousands of articles on leaks within municipalities, and it is a serious problem. I just can't speak to it because we were fortunate. Ours just floats to the system. Now, Lubbock is still doing the same thing that everybody else is doing. We're still having trouble getting the financing on top of acquiring water rights and also to make repairs to our system. So we spend an inordinate amount of money repairing our system as opposed to replacing it. Plus, we have growth issues here in Lubbock. People are moving out. We've got urban sprawl. So we're chasing that customer while trying to maintain the customer in the center, city in the center, as well as replacing and repairing systems. So we're just in a better situation than most as far as leakage. However, we've got the same issues that everybody else does. So our water loss here in Lubbock is actually very small, and I would imagine it's very similar throughout this region.
Okay, we've got breakout sessions at lunch, so we need to wrap this up. I want to give each of the speakers one final chance to say 30 seconds of whatever they'd like to leave us with, and then we'll have to break up. Go ahead. Let you start, Judy, if you have anything. If you don't, you can just pass.
Obviously am an advocate for sustainability of the aquifer. We all know that of all aquifers, that water supply, the water is the vital resource that is going to drive our economies and make our decisions in the future. So,
I'll mention, if you want to read more about water demand trends from the urban or municipal side and some of the challenges with financing and creditworthiness, we have just a quick white paper update on bond market risks and steps that investors and credit rating agencies can take around this, along with water systems. So it's in the back of the room. Feel free to pick one up. Thanks.
I'll just mention one quick thing. Groundwater conservation districts are the preferred method of managing groundwater in the state of Texas, not only from the state level, but I think also from the producer's level. When we're talking managed depletion versus sustainability, I believe that groundwater conservation districts are looking at sustainability. I just think that at some point in time, it's all going to look a little different depending on where you're at. I agree with Judy when she says that we need to see what new economies are going to keep us here in West Texas, because I personally want to be here forever, whether it's agriculture or not. But I think that managing what we've got is essential, and I think that the boards of the water districts, particularly over the Ogallala, are very committed to doing that, while also allowing what's going on, well, keeping our industries in place as well. I hope it's ag, but okay. I'm not sure that it is.
Go ahead.
So very quickly, I actually wanted to address your question, Stephanie, about next cost-effective short-term step. I really think conserving energy also conserves water, and conserving water really conserves energy. And I think getting people, the general public, to really think about those things and how linked they are is a really important message for people to understand.
I want to say thank you to the panelists and let you know that I have my business cards in the back of the room. If you want any additional information from the panelists, I can get that for you and would be happy to do that. Thank you guys for giving us a good panel. Y'all have a great rest of the day.
Yeah, you too.